Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of our society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they're doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. The most caring thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to transition to Yahweh's Torah, which means teaching, not law. Because using evidence and reason to explore it, we will find the most enriching gift ever offered, Yah's covenant, which is the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 3 hours, is 877-376-45. The reason I hesitated there, I just received an email that indicates that on Thursday, during the 10:30 hour Eastern time, I'll be a guest on Mancow's show. Mancow is now a GCN host, having moved from TRN during TRN's demise. And he is syndicated out of Chicago. You may know Mancow for the television program that he does with his brother, Guns and Glory, or whatever it's called, the car dealer in the, I think, somewhere in the Midwest. Anyway, he's an interesting character, very quick, fast-tempoed program. Done his show 4 or 5 times in the past, and look forward to doing it again. In the news, I want to begin with something that was lightly covered in the media. The story begins that Arinda Wright Allen, in fact, she has four names. It's Arinda L. Wright Allen, made history in 2011 by becoming the first black woman nominated to serve as a federal district judge in Virginia. Now, I am not one who celebrates these kinds of things. A person's gender, as it relates to being a judge, ought to be irrelevant. I really don't care if they're male or female, and you shouldn't either. One's race is also irrelevant. When you begin to view people based upon their gender or their race, then you will almost invariably lose sight of their message. Now, I have an issue with Arinda L. Wright Allen, but it has nothing to do with the fact that she's female or that she is African-American or that some thinks that she made history. I don't view it that way. On Thursday, she cemented her legacy, according to this article, I think it was from the Washington Post, with a sweeping decision striking down Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage. In a moment, she said, makes our freedom more perfect. The 53-year-old jurist, nominated by President Barack Hussein Obama, joins an unbroken string of federal judges to side with same-sex marriage proponents since the Supreme Court delivered gay rights victories on the subject in June. But her forceful and sometimes grandiose 41-page ruling issued on the eve of Valentine's Day, and including an unapologetic defense of a federal judge's duty to strike down a democratic decision that may intrude on constitutional rights, seemed to draw special attention to itself. The point I want to make is that your vote means nothing. America is not a democracy. And the sooner you come to recognize these things, the better. In California, for example, there is the initiative process, as there now is in a number of states, including Virginia. The initiative process at least moves a representative government, a republic, if you will, towards embracing some aspects of democracy. You see, the difference between representative government, a republic, and a democracy is that in a republic, people choose their leaders who then make their decisions based upon a constitution. In a democracy, those who are vested in the society, those who are contributors to the society, typically called oligarchs in today's parlance, make every decision. There aren't elected officials who are making the decisions as in a representative form of government, but instead the population who is invested in the society because they own land, they own businesses, they are productively engaged contributing to the society, they are given the opportunity to decide every material action of the government. Who it goes to war with, when it doesn't choose to go to war, when how much it spends in what area, when it's going to build a road, and how it's going to build it, and who's going to do it for them. I mean, every aspect of a democracy is legislated by the people themselves. This toying with democracy, this initiative process that exists in California, has been turned asunder by federal judges. 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 10 million people can vote for a law that one judge will overturn. That is not democracy. That's not even representative government. It's not a republic either. But what it does mean is that the federal government has no interest in what the people want. And that judges will very often and typically rule in ways that is completely or are completely outside of their jurisprudence, outside of the area that they've been authorized to rule. You know, about 90% of the decisions made by the Supreme Court have no basis in the U.S. Constitution. And yet they go to great lengths to try to justify constitutionally their choice. This is an example. There is no basis in the U.S. Constitution for determining whether or not the term marriage applies strictly to men and women, and say, for example, the term civil union could apply to others who want exactly the same protection. So regardless of what your position is on homosexual marriage, I want you to recognize that your vote doesn't matter, that you're being played for a fool if you are voting. And I would strongly encourage you to stop. Victoria Cobb, who is the president of the Family Foundation of Virginia, labeling the ruling an emotional outburst, an emotional outburst. The release of the ruling the night before Valentine's Day, she said at a news conference, reeks of a political show and of a personal political agenda. I would agree. The judge, saying that by her striking down the will of the people, that it makes our freedom more perfect, is utter nonsense. You know, there is, and I don't want to get into the debate on homosexual marriage other than to say this. The term marriage is a term that has described men and women marrying, getting together officially in an officially recognized union by whether it be the government or even the religious establishment of the land. And as husband and wife conceiving and raising children in a home, typically sharing the same name, sharing the same finances, sharing the responsibility of raising children. That's the purpose of marriage. That's been the definition of marriage. In the quest for homosexuals to be considered normal, and a behavior we have to admit, and let's just use evidence and reason, 1% to 2% of the population is homosexual. Therefore, it's an abnormal behavior. But what homosexuals want is to not only be considered normal, but to be considered superior. And so anything that is afforded to heterosexual couples, they want afforded to them. They want the credibility that goes along with the term marriage. That's what they're seeking. Now, this is a moot point, because if you were to take a poll 20 or 30 years ago of America, the Americans would have sided against homosexual marriage about 90-10. Today, if you were to take that same poll, you'd find that Americans side in favor of it about 70-30. And the difference is the indoctrination of younger people in academic institutions that chose to take this issue and make it the cause célèbre, to have administrations and school officials endorse this specific agenda. And so most young people in their teens, 20s, and 30s that have been educated, indoctrinated over the last 20 or 30 years have come out almost universally saying, yes, they favor homosexual marriage. So this is an issue that cannot be won. It's just a matter of time. And now undermining the hint of democracy in America, the courts are taking and shortening that amount of time. The quote here from Victoria Cobb, I'll end with, says, legislating through the courts against the will of the people is lawless disregard for our representative form of government. Actually, it would be for our attempt to be a democracy, Marshall said in a speech on the House of Delegates floor. House of Delegates is a Virginia legislative body. Turning to the next item in the news, the dateline is Cairo, but it's only because there are almost no journalists in Libya because it's way too dangerous a place. After America aided and abetted the jihadists in their takeover of a secular government, it is now a terrorist haven. So the report is out of Cairo, and it says that a Libyan military official announced that he had suspended parliament and that he had a new roadmap to the future and that he had successfully taken charge of Libya. Only one thing. No one paid any attention. There is no parliament. I found this next story especially perplexing, but I did want to share it with you because so many Americans from the Northwest to the Southeast and along all of the northeastern quarter and throughout much of the Midwest have been in a freezer for the entirety of this winter, which came hard, which came early, and which continues to linger. Also, it's relevant to say that before I present this story, that although we began a period of global warming under the normal 750-year cycle of warm to cool to warm to cool back around 1875, that in the last 18 years, there's been no change whatsoever in the Earth's temperature. And in the last 2 to 3 years, we've actually had a precipitous decline in the overall temperature. We're experiencing global cooling. Now, those are the facts. But there is a political agenda that lurks all around the facts. This story from the Washington Post reads, new research suggests that the main system that helps determine the weather over Northern Europe and North America may be changing. The study shows that the so-called jet stream has increasingly taken a longering, meandering path, and that this has resulted in weather remaining the same for prolonged periods of time. All right, what they're claiming is that in the Arctic, that the temperatures have risen, and therefore the temperature differential between the Arctic and the temperate regions is not as significant, and therefore one aspect of the jet stream, which causes it to move north to south, is weaker. Now, if it's weaker you could see that high and low pressure systems might cause it to move, but if it's going to be weaker and thus more susceptible to high and low pressures, then it should not stay in one place as long, which it would be wholly counter to their argument. So the very fact that the jet stream is weaker and therefore is going to be more susceptible to highs and lows is the antithesis of what the evidence is purporting, which is that we are locked into long periods right now of cold. Also, the NASA, in conjunction with the climatologist cadre that is so vocal these days politically, suggesting that global warming is a result of man, NASA, along with climatologists, had forecast that in the summer of 2013, last summer, that the Arctic would be ice-free, that it would be the first time that it would be possible to sail a surface craft north of Alaska and Canada. Now, not only did that not turn out as they had forecast, there was a 60% greater ice pack this past year than at any time previously recorded. So rather than them getting the effect of a much colder, a much warmer Arctic with a de minimis ice pack, the actual results were the antithesis of this, saying that rather than the Arctic warming, it's cooling based upon the ice pack. Well, the work was presented at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of the Sciences in Chicago. According to Professor Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University in New Jersey, quote, this does seem to suggest that weather patterns are changing and that people are noticing that weather in their area is not what it used to be, end quote. Yeah, that's true. Weather patterns are changing. They have always changed. They will never stop changing. The moment weather patterns stop changing, then our Earth will have ceased to be in a position where it can support life. The meandering jet stream has accounted for the recent stormy weather over the UK and the bitter winter weather in the US Midwest remaining longer than it otherwise would have. We can expect more of the same, and we expect for it to happen more frequently, says Professor Francis. But if the easterly movement of the air in the jet stream is based solely on the Earth's rotation, but the southern movement is based upon a differential in temperature and therefore differential in pressure, but if it's weaker for the basis that they've claimed, then it would not stay in one position longer, it would be there for a shorter period of time as highs and lows and fronts move across the country. Something here tells me that these are folks that know a lot but fail to understand anything. This article from the Washington Post continues with the following information. The jet stream, as its name suggests, is a high-speed air current in the atmosphere that brings with it the weather. And, you know, that's partially true, not completely true. The jet stream is not always even high speed. There are times when, and it's called the jet stream mainly because it's at the level in the atmosphere, it begins anywhere from 10 to 15,000 feet, but is typically of serious concern between 25,000 and 45,000 feet. And the higher you go, typically the stronger it is, and of course it works against jets, any aircraft flying from east to west because of the rotation of the Earth. And at certain times of the year, it has a tendency to fall and go in more of a diagonal motion towards the south than it does at other times of the year. So it's called the jet stream because it does affect jet aircraft, but its speed can vary. I've flown west when the jet stream was 15 to 20 knots at altitude, and when it was 125 knots at altitude. So it can vary a great deal. It is not the only source of bringing weather. It does influence the weather, but high and low pressure systems also have an enormous influence on weather. In fact, I'd say that high and low pressure systems have a bigger influence on weather than just the jet stream. Now, this article says it is fueled partly by the temperature differential between the Arctic and the mid-latitudes. Well, it is fueled primarily by the rotation of the Earth and secondarily by that temperature differential, because the temperature differential creates high and low relative pressures. The colder the air, the denser the air, the higher pressure the air, the warmer the air, the less dense the air, the lower the pressure. It's kind of the same thing if you were to take water, and if you go under 30 feet of water, you're now at two relative altitudes, where if you boil water, warm it, it turns into a gas and is a lot less dense. Now, if the differential is large, the jet stream speeds up like a river flowing down a steep hill, and it plows through any obstacles, such as areas of high pressure that might be in its way. So, you know, if the differential is substantial, the jet stream has a tendency just to follow the rotation of the Earth. But if the differential is less, then it has a tendency to be more effective by high and low pressures. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that right now the temperatures in North America and in Northern Europe are very cold. And so the relatively cold temperatures in Europe and North America would have exactly the same effect as if the temperatures were artificially warmer over the Arctic. You follow the logic there? That if the jet stream is weaker because of the difference in pressure differential, temperature differential leading to pressure differential, it can work either way. And we know for certain that the temperatures are colder in North America and Northern Europe. So a temperature differential in the Arctic is therefore not the driving factor. This article says the temperature differential reduces because of a warming Arctic. If the temperature differential reduces because of a warming Arctic, then the jet stream weakens, and it, like a river on a flat bed, it will meander every time it comes across an obstacle. Well, if it was meandering every time it comes across an obstacle, which would be a high or low pressure system, then you would expect it to move around and not create the environment that we're witnessing, which are prolonged stormy periods. As I've said, the realization is we've got global cooling in the Northern Hemisphere and really significant global cooling in the Northern Hemisphere. For example, this is the first time in 60 or 70 years that Lake Superior has frozen over. And Lake Superior right now is so deeply frozen to the tune of 3, 4, and 5 feet thick with ice. They're now expecting the Lake Superior to be iced over through August. You know, briefly opening up and then freezing over again. And we are experiencing global cooling in the midst of a period that should have global warming. And so what they're not revealing here is more to the point than what they are revealing here. And this is being presented as purposefully misleading by scientists who will take the banter of we're only about the truth, evidence and reason, and yet they are misleading anyone who pays attention to this. The results in weather patterns tending to become stuck over areas for weeks on end is what they say is the consequence of this. But if it's weaker, it should, rather than being stuck and being able to, you know, plow through and therefore maintain its position, the opposite effect should be the case. It also drives cold weather further south and warm weather further north. Now, that's not true either. If it was stronger, If the differential was stronger, it would drive the cold weather further south. If it's weaker, it would not do so. So I can't tell you if it's the scientists who are irrational here, who can look at the evidence and cannot make a reasoned conclusion based on the evidence because they unfortunately earn their degrees in schools that no longer teach rational decision making, or it's the journalist who is so confused that he or she hasn't gotten any of this right. But it is a great example as to how a major periodical, the Washington Post, can present information that is universally inaccurate. CNN is reporting a story that is just too tantalizing for words. A Kentucky pastor who starred in a reality show about snake handling in church has died of a snake bite. Jamie Coots died Saturday evening after refusing to be treated. On Snake Salvation, the ardent Pentecostal believer said that he believed that a passage in the Bible suggests poisonous snake bites will not harm believers as long as they are anointed by God. The practice is illegal in most states, but goes on primarily in the rural South. You know, I have mocked Pentecostals for a long time. Those who claim that they're speaking in the tongues of angels have completely, I can't even say misinterpreted, because there is no way to misinterpret what is presented relative to the fulfillment of Shavuah when the Spirit came upon the children of the covenant who had already benefited that same year from Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, and enriched them with the knowledge of Yahweh's Torah teaching and empowered them with the Spirit so that they could speak human languages. And it even lists the countries whose languages they were able to speak to convey that message. And so this idea of speaking in the tongues of angels is purely Pauline, absolutely ridiculous, and has no merit whatsoever. Because if you were to speak in the language of Yahweh's messengers, the Malach, you'd be speaking Hebrew, not some idiotic gobbledygook nonsense. Now, the notion that there is a passage that says, yep, what God is looking for here is he wants to test your faith by having you get bit by poisonous snakes. Yep, venomous snakes, they are your friend. Now, mind you, that beginning in the first book of the Torah, the venomous snake is associated with Hasatan, Satan, the adversary. And venom is associated with religion, the poison of religion. It's the antithesis of what these guys are claiming is actually true. It's saying, you know, be wary of the serpents because what they are conveying is deadly. It's poisonous. It's going to kill you. And yet these morons take exactly the opposite point of view. Well, it certainly demonstrated the veracity of their faith, did it not? Coots was a third-generation serpent handler and aspired to one day pass the practice and his church full gospel tabernacle and Jesus' name onto his adult son, little Cody. Just think about that. Gospel. Pagan terms. I mean, it's Gott's spell. Gott is the name of the Teutonic sun god. Spell is what magicians, soothsayers would cast upon the unsuspecting. Jesus didn't exist. There is no one even remotely akin to Jesus. And, of course, it is a church, which is another pagan attribute. On Sunday, National Geographic Channel spokesperson Stephanie Montgomery sent CNN this statement, quote, in following Pastor Coots for our series, Snake Salvation, now what in the world was National Geographic doing, tantalizing viewers with this kind of rubbish? You know, it's like the History Channel doing alien invasion shows. You know, you lose all credibility. You know, it's why I don't do conspiracy theory on this program. National Geographic ought not do Snake Salvation. History Channel ought not do alien encounters. National Geographic spokesman said, "We were constantly struck by his devout religious convictions, despite the health and legal peril he often faced." Now, why would a scientific institution, the National Geographic Society, be interested in devout religious convictions, particularly ones as stupid as this? Quote, "Their risks were always worth it to him and his congregants as a means to demonstrate their unwavering faith." Well, you know, that's the problem with faith. There ain't no way to prove it. And when you seek to prove that which is basically impossible to prove, because that's the definition of faith, you end up looking stupid, just as this fellow did. In fact, what you end up looking is dead. Everyone who has chosen a religious faith will end up that way, except those who promote it. They will end up enduring Sheol, separation from God for all eternity. The National Geographic says they were even honored to have access to Pastor Jamie and his congregation, that it was an honor to experience their worship. This next story is brought to us by the Washington Post. It's written in the first person. It begins, "When I signed on Thursday," this journalist was using a variation of AOL, as if he hasn't recognized that AOL is a dinosaur these days. But nonetheless, he was using AOL, and a headline flashed across the screen saying something about the Shroud of Turin. Instinct said, "Look away, nothing good can come from reading a Shroud of Turin article. This is a fact-free zone." But I was weak, and I looked, and soon discovered that I'd plunged down the rabbit hole of pseudoscience and bunk. It was a Huffington Post article. The headline read, "Shroud of Turin formed by an earthquake? Scientists say face of Jesus image caused by neutron emissions." He then writes, "Be wary. Always when you see scientists say formulation, they rarely speak in unison like that." Yeah, that is absolutely true. And scientists aren't going to comment on the face of Jesus. As for the story itself, they're claiming that there was a massive earthquake. Yes, a 11, what they say, on the Richter scale. Now, mind you, the Richter scale hasn't been around that long, and the strongest earthquake ever recorded using the Richter scale was a 9.5, and it's geometric, so 11 would be many, many times, hundreds of times stronger than a 9.5. And there is no evidence of an earthquake of that magnitude rocking the Middle East at this time in 33 CE. They cited the writer Dante, who was born 12 centuries later, as their source of the earthquake. Now, there was an earthquake, and there are some telltale signs and recordings in regions surrounding Israel of the earthquake on Pesach in 33 CE. There's evidence of where the fault is on Mount Moriah. There's evidence of being recorded in surrounding cultures. There's even evidence of it in terms of a resulting dust layer. But neutron emissions, and that the neutron emissions only affected the shroud? Are they crazy? Now, I happen to be one of those who actually thinks this shroud is the one artifact by the Roman Catholic Church. It's actually likely to be credible. And I say that because of the nature of the image. It's an image that has been radiated from the inside out, as if an enormous amount of energy came at the physical body of the Passover lamb and evaporated the physical body, leaving a radiation image, like a photographic negative, on the underside of the shroud. And therefore, when they unwrap the shroud, you get the image of someone who has been recently crucified. The arms and legs are, you know, the arms are pulled out of their socket and elongated. You see the actual way it was done with the nails through the wrists, not the hands. You see the single nail that would have gone through the between the ankle and the heel area. You see even in this particular thing not only the crown of thorns but also the result of being whipped with the bone and metal tipped Roman flagellums that pulled the flesh away from the body. Highly likely that image, based upon what we know of the consequence of crucifixion and the way that it is delivered, is accurate, because what the Christians, of course, want to do is they want to explain how in the world the image is there and the body just, it's gone out of the image. What they don't recognize is that to fulfill the Torah, to be Torah observant, Yosha's body had to be incinerated that evening. And so it ceased to exist, and this just really explains the process that was used to incinerate it and leaves us with an interesting portrayal of what is left. But it is pathetic how people, grasping for straws because they haven't a clue what happened, that they will propose such silly ideas. Turning now to the Middle East, many of you may know that Muslims are acting badly again in Egypt. An explosion ripped through a bus carrying South Korean tourists in the Sinai Peninsula this past weekend, killing three people. It was the deadliest attack on vacationers here in years, signaling an escalation in the fight by Islamist militants against the Egyptian government. You know, it's interesting that Zawahiri, the number two of Al-Qaeda that is now number one, maybe the only member active in Al-Qaeda, made a living killing tourists in Egypt.